But tonight we have Ariella McCarthy, and she's written a book called The Power of the Possible, a book of hope and inspiration. And I've been learning that many, many people have found this to be of great assistance in their lives. So I'm very grateful for Ariella for you coming to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, hello, everybody. It's so wonderful to be here. You know, I've never been to this store, and maybe I've been to Sebastopol a couple of times. Only because I live an hour away, I live in Southern Marine. It's like I walked in and I was home. And there was nobody here but Amber. And what do you know, we're both from the same country. The last thing you expect. And I've been here for almost 30 years. And she said she came when she was 21. I said, what, you've been here for a year? And she said a little longer. No, much longer though. Anyway, so hence the accent. You don't lose your accent after 9 years. It's a biological thing. So, anyway, dry mouth. So I'm thrilled to be here. The book came out a year ago, and I did a great number of book talks. Started on the East Coast, and then Bay Area, pretty much everywhere. But... Then I stopped somewhere in the fall, so if I'm a little rusty, I hope not, but if I am, it's because it's been a little while. Though I have a radio show, and so once a week I do record an hour, kind of unprepared. So talking started coming much easier to me.
Where is your, what station is your radio?
The radio show is internet radio. I've discovered that such a thing exists after I was invited to do it. Last year in December, before the book even came out, I did one. If you don't know about internet radio in general, it's unbelievable what's going on. And it's very convenient because if you discover the host that you like, you can listen anytime, basically. 24/7, it plays. Next week, the new show comes up, and this one goes to podcast and still available for many months. So, about 25,000 listeners listen to my show, which is a week, so flabbergasting to me, very humbling, and I don't know who they are.
They know who you are.
So I started appealing to them, just saying, look, I'm so grateful that you're listening, could you please send me a couple of words of who you are? Well, they don't. Except if they ask questions, and then they do. Then I get emails. Emails I get, but other than that, no. No, that's, I understand that, don't you? I just want to tell you first. So anyway, The Power of the Possible. The title is a little misleading because it suggests that what the book is about is believe that it is possible and then it will be so. Which of course is a higher truth, as I'm sure everybody knows. But also, probably most people know by now, that it is not so simple. Believing is not easy very often if a lot of other things are happening internally. You cannot make yourself believe something you really don't until you heal enough so you can. The Power of the Possible, the title, came out very magically. I'll tell you in a second because it's an interesting story. But what it means here, what's possible, what becomes possible, what opens up once we surrender, once we stop insisting on getting our way, once we stop fighting to have it our way. In other words, letting go of our control, the C word. And that is usually, for the most part, it's a transcendent moment if it happens to a person. And it is very often a moment of utter pain, but it's a very real one. When you realize that everything you've done, trying to break through every wall that was in your way, hasn't worked. And there's nothing you can do. And that incredibly powerful moment of utter powerlessness, but not powerlessness as a weakness, not resignation, not giving up, but truly letting go. That level of surrender, very real. It can last for a second, for a minute, or it can last. We don't know how long it lasts because we lose sense of time. And that moment is when everything opens up and we lift it and everything shifts and the power of the possible enters into our life. And we are changed beyond anything we can imagine. And when we come to, we're different. Consequently, our life is different. And things in our life are different. And that's what the book is about. But not the theory. I decided, although there are very many how-to books, and some of them are really very good, I think that we really learn best and get it best when we can relate to another person who's gone through the same experience. In other words, we hear a story. We hear a story, and even though the circumstances can be completely different than ours, the issues are the same. We all deal with the same issue in the living of life, and we all want the same thing, more or less. Yeah? So, and when we read about somebody else as if it is, as if we're reading about ourselves, then we can really change, get where we need to get, what was missing, that one missing piece perhaps. So that's how I wrote the book. It's all true stories, but because I'm a writer, they're not written as case studies, but they're written as if you're reading a book of fiction. You're really drawn into the story, except in the introduction. If you read the introduction, you know that they're true, that they. Of course, the names are changed, the geographical details are changed. A few things are changed just to protect the privacy, but otherwise, no. So, every story has a miraculous, magical ending. And because it happens in life, it makes it even more powerful. And the triumph of each character in each story is not of will, but of surrender. So it's quite incredible. It's more or less, you know, we have, why are the cliches cliches? Because they are the truth, right? But we don't respond to them because we've heard them a million times. Most of the time. But that's more or less about letting go and letting God. Only through examples of what happened. But, and as we finish the story, then I go back kind of and explain. So there is theory, and there is a little bit of how to minimal. The point is, I wanted to write it in such a way. I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to write it in such a way that the shift happens just through reading. It's more or less, and that's what I got very thrilled actually, because that was my intention. But you never know if you'll succeed or not. But I got quite a number of emails saying that to me, that it is almost between the words. You know, the words are there, but the energy. Well, every good book, or every book that touches a person, it's a channel. You know, whatever it is, you channel. The information is channeled. So, if it's right for not every book is right for everyone. Not every author, not every teacher. Thank God there are so many different paths all leading in the same direction. So, if it's right for you, then this will. There's a chance it will happen. So, awakening is a very big word, but and it didn't happen to me like to some people it did. Eckhart Tolle woke up, changed. I know of others like that, but mostly awakening happens gradually, like the dawn. The more light comes in, more and more with time, and this is a never-ending process. So, that is it.
Where did you get your stories from?
I got the stories from life. Some of them are mine. Some of them are people that I know well. Some of them are people that I participated in their, you know, in helping this happen. But they're not all my clients. It was because this has been my focus. Love has been my focus of my life. Making love work. Why? It is so hard. We know that love is all there is, But we also have learned, I'm sure everyone has, that it is not enough. So why isn't it enough? Or what do we need to do to make it enough if it is all there is? So it's because it's been my focus, and my focus on my own internal work and process, I also paid attention. And I saw when, you know, when it happened, maybe you, other people may have heard the same story but didn't catch that particular, you know, thing there, why. So, no, but the story is up from there.
What service?
I'll answer that, but in general, we'll have time for questions.
Oh.
Go ahead.
What service do you offer people? Are you like a minister or a psychologist or a spiritual teacher?
Spiritual teacher. Those that look at too big a word, but it's the closest, yeah. Yeah, I do seminars and some one-on-one meditatively. But that's what I offer. Okay, so I lost my track of train of thought. Many questions that people grapple with, and all of us do, is if I am sure that I am right, how can I get through? And why can't I get through? Well, that's more or less the premise of the book, because originally the title was going to be How to Stop Being Right and Start Being Happy. And yeah, and it's a little kind of a gimmicky too, but I had such a response, you know, from the publisher and from everybody that I decided, okay, well, everyone seems to love it, and everybody knows that it has to be a catchy title, so that let's keep the title. And in the very end, when the book was already, you know, pretty much laid, the publisher called me, it was laid out, they knew how many, it was all edited, done, how many pages, how many, you know, what size. And in the conversation, matter of fact, he's in New York and I'm in Mill Valley, and he is telling me, and by the way, I didn't know you changed the title. I love the new title. That's how it happened. And I said, well, what do you mean I changed the title? I never changed the title. What are you talking about? I'm looking at, you know, it's all in front of me and the title is different. So I'm saying, David, what's the title? And he says, it's the power of the possible. I love it. Now, I had a smile, you know. It was alone. It could have been on camera. Because I just couldn't believe what was happening. I do use the term through the book, the expression, the power of the possible. But it didn't occur to me to name the book that, which was very obvious, perfectly correct title. But it just didn't occur to me. So I said, well, I didn't put it there. He goes, well, then who did? I said, well, did you? He goes, no. Well, I didn't either. Until today, we don't know who. So, and this man, the last person you would expect to hear something like what I'll just tell you, but I heard from him, and I said, so who do you think put the title there? And he said, the universe. And that's because the world is changing. You know, confirmations like that, when you hear from the last person, you will expect that answer. You know? That's nice. So, well. You want me to read to you? You want to tell me to tell you a little bit more what it is about? Or if you want
your story. I'd also like to know more about you.
About me. Okay, well, I was born in the Soviet Union. It was Latvia. Now it is an independent country, one of the three republics of on the Baltic Sea, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Well, at that time it was one of the Soviet republics. And Riga is the capital, and that's where I was born. And it was multi. Every republic in the Soviet Union had two cultures, its own culture and Russian culture. So ethnically, I'm really not Latvian. My parents came to Latvia right after the Second World War. It was a nice place to live. It was more Western. This is where I was growing up. And my education is in English and English literature. After, love wasn't working in my life. That being my focus. I was married, I'm talking about living here already, I was married, I had a son, and what started as a very happy marriage wasn't happy anymore. We were basically growing in opposite directions and having less and less in common. It's very difficult to break a marriage, especially when there is no obvious apparent reason, like no one's cheating, no one's beating, nobody's stealing. No. From objectively, it was a picture-perfect marriage, and we had a picture-perfect life. We had an art gallery, was an art dealer. We had a beautiful home, and nobody even knew that there was any problem. Except because we were civilized people, we didn't fight in public. But it was really, pretty much I was dying inside. And he wasn't happy either. It intensified after I discovered spirituality. For some reason, it's like that was the last straw. I had a couple of incidents of internal bleeding with the ulcer where almost I could have died because I didn't know what was going on, and all the while it was in blood. Well, I didn't die, of course, thank goodness. I didn't think I would die, but the doctors thought I could. I realized that I had to leave, and I left. And I did a very amazing internal process. It was a trial separation, but trial, quote unquote. You know, when you're not ready to tell yourself the truth, you call it a trial separation. And during that, it was about 50 days or so, in summer, during my intense cleaning process, I have learned how to do it, and I now help others with it, people who can't make a decision to stay or to leave, because we don't know what you want. And you think you want this, but maybe you don't, because there's too much going on. And I didn't know what to do. I knew this wasn't working, but to break everything is a very difficult thing, especially when, you know, your husband doesn't even take it seriously and thinks it's a phase and you're coming home. And then I woke up one morning crystal clear. I mean, I went to bed at night and I said to myself, I'm taking myself off the hook. Whenever I know I'm just letting go of controlling anything. Because I gave myself time and I still didn't know and I finished the process. And I woke up, and it was like this one of those moments of surrender where you go to bed, one person wake up, another, and it was clear that it's over. Well, we're very good friends now, and it works for us much better. Not immediately, but yes, and we both remarried. I remarried very happily, and everything that I didn't work through in my first marriage came up in my second. But in the beginning, not right away, there were not many. This was like really the right person for me. So, and he's mentioned throughout. This is not about me, but there are snippets as it's appropriate throughout the book. So people who read the book always say, now we know you. Because, you know, I'm very intimate with the readers. If I share something, then I share it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't. So, well, that's about me. I discovered my spiritual path, and there was no looking back. And life kind of turned around. It's been 20 years since. So then the time came to write the book. I was writing before, because my life is very interesting as far as what happened. But at some point I lost interest in my story. And then I just didn't care anymore, and I put it in the drawer. I have about 350 pages written. So my publisher wants them out. Maybe I'll rekindle the passion, but I don't know. But this I wrote in 10 months. Pretty much just kind of. And everything with this book was magic, just all the doors open. You know, with publishing, and I don't have an agent. Just met the publisher at a conference. Well, it's just things that, you know, when the doors open, they open. And when they don't, you can't break through. You may try. We all have. So I write a lot about forgiveness. Forgiveness has so much controversy around it. I didn't know there was so much controversy. But as I started doing work around forgiveness more publicly, especially last summer, in when I was doing it together with the Worldwide Forgiveness Alliance, headquarters is in the Valley, and I was connecting with international, there's tons of organizations worldwide around forgiveness. And that's when I was, to my shock, what I was hearing, well, we don't know if it's right to forgive or not, we're just presenting it as a just something to think about. And so I realized how much work there still is to do, to basically to explain, because, you know, not that people are dumb, they're not dumb, but it's just lack of awareness sometimes. How can I forgive this horrendous thing? So there's a lot about this here. Basically, forgiveness is for us. It doesn't take away accountability of that person or responsibility, but it's between them and God and them and their consciousness. The question is, do we want to carry that pain the rest of our life and live out of it, or do we want it free? That's putting it into words. But we don't have a lot of time to cover everything. Write a lot about... basically, why... Just I'll finish with this. Why... The original title was How to Stop Being Right and Start Being Happy. Because I looked around, starting with myself, and I saw the world as large, macrocosm and microcosm, on every level, where everyone is sure that they're right. You take lovers fighting, you take parents and children, you take neighbors, people at work, you take governments, you take countries, whatever, wherever you want to look, everybody has a point. And they do. And everybody is sure that they're right, and the other one has to get it. And nothing changes. So, what to do? Obviously, this is not the way. It hasn't worked ever. That's what the book is about, why it doesn't work. And I really understood the dynamic, because when we try to change somebody for their... On the phone, I heard in the beginning when the book came out, for the first several months, I did a lot of radio interviews, where I was being interviewed. And inevitably, I was asked the same question. Well, you're saying that you shouldn't try to change the other person, but how can we know? I said, well, give me an example. Well, my uncle is an alcoholic, and he's just... My aunt is going crazy, and the family is going crazy, and he's drinking himself to death, and we're all terrified. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? Well, we're talking to him. Does it work? Has it worked? No, it hasn't. Point is, it never does. And that's very painful to realize, but also very liberating. So what to do? What happens is when we are sure. And the alcoholic example is very obvious. A lot of examples are much less obvious. But even the obvious ones are never that clear. There are always a lot of depth and underlining sort of reasons. And who are we to know how the other person needs to grow? You know, we're not a goddess. We're not the soul. We don't know why this path is chosen. We can only choose for ourselves to be around or not. We can love them, but we don't have to be there. Or we can be there and accept. But basically, when we're sure that they need to change, what happens is, whether we insist and talk a lot about it and try to explain very passionately, very quietly, or very softly, or we stop talking but we just hold and think, you know, and just watch. It doesn't matter. As long as that energy is there, they know it. It can't be hidden. They know it. So how is that experienced? It's experienced as a violation. It's experienced as an attack. Doesn't matter how soft. And what is the knee-jerk response to an attack? Fight back. Doesn't matter right or wrong. It's a knee-jerk human response. You come at me, or you come at me, stay away. Right? So even if you have a point, you're not going to be heard. If you have an agenda for them to hear it. Runs you that, because what happens is the energy comes back at you, and now there's this whole mix, field of interference, nobody sees each other. You can't see them. All you see is that he's not getting it, and he has to. He can't see you nor hear what you're saying, because he has to fight you back. He or she resists, so nothing can change. What happens if we let go? Out of pain, out of wisdom, out of brilliant insight, realize there's nothing I can do. Basically, this is the premise for all 12-step program, Al-Anon especially. If you just stop, okay, and what happens to this field of interference? It collapses. It's no longer there. Now it's clear, right? So if we were to use a metaphor now, this wall that was there before is replaced by a mirror. And that person now can see themselves for the first time. So two things may happen, a change and so on, or not. Very often, they do change. But if they don't, either way, you're free. You're no longer in this, because you're not free when you're trying. Well, look at the taking international conflict. You can be on this side or on that side, but it doesn't matter. If you talk to people on either side, they all have a point. And they all have a point. So, okay. Shall I read a little bit? Or shall we talk? Questions? What time is it? 8 o'clock. Well, we're fine, right? So, shall I read?
Yes, that would be great.
This is the hardest thing for me, by the way, to decide what to read. Never know what to read. To me, it's all interesting, you know? Well, I can be objective. Well, you want a story or you want thoughts?
Story.
And now?
Then thoughts.
Hmm?
Then thoughts.
Story then thoughts. Okay. The quote throughout the book, and could stand for the book, nothing changes until we do. It's not my quote, but I love it. So I use it. Okay, I'll just read a little bit from the very first chapter. And it's called, the chapter is called, What Can I Do to Get Him to Change? I'll read this one because that's what we're talking about. To be truly seen is to be truly healed. Marianne Williamson. What can I do to get him to change? My friend asked me. We were sitting in an outdoor cafe on a quiet Sunday afternoon, drinking our lattes and talking. How can I make him understand? She frowned, throwing her hands in the air, spilling some of her coffee onto the tablecloth. She moved the saucer to cover the stain and searched my face. There must be a way to get through to him. I knew what would follow next. A heartfelt and angry explanation of why the change is necessary and how she has tried everything to ignore the way. We had talked about it before many times, but my answers were never what she wanted to hear. How can I get him to see that I'm right? What can I do? She insisted. She was at her wit's end. I reached for my coffee. How's your father doing? I asked, changing the subject. Is he still on the golf course a lot? It is a fascinating phenomenon, this conviction that you know what's best for another person, and you can actually do something to change that person. Who among us hasn't, at one time or another, felt certain that we have the right to interfere with the life of another and correct it for the better? Husbands and wives, lovers and friends, partners in businesses and in life, siblings, governments, neighbors, at home and at work. Relentlessly, people fight to get others to see their point and change accordingly. But no one does. Again and again I hear the same old song. How can I get Jake to stop drinking? I've tried everything, but he just won't listen. What can I do to get Sarah to see that she needs to leave her abusive husband while she is still alive? How can I get my mother to stop smoking? It's killing her, and still she won't stop. Am I supposed to just sit there and wait for her to get lung cancer? A tired, frustrated chorus, determined to get its way, yet never getting it. What can I do to get them to change? They begin. Nothing, I usually say. Absolutely nothing. We've all been there. We've tried everything. Exhausting every means of expression. Scratching our foreheads until they bled. But it never made any difference. We kept hitting a wall of resistance. At times it was mind-blowing how impenetrable, how unmovable our loved ones were. Against all logic, contrary to common sense, stubbornly, and oh, so stupidly, we were sure, they fought us back every inch of the way. They resisted our pleas and threats. They ignored our cold withdrawals. They were unmoved by our tears and unaffected by our promises to leave. At times, it looked as if they were ready to lose everything that mattered to them just so they could continue to act the way they wanted to. Have you ever wondered why, no matter how convincing you were, it never worked? Have you ever been dumbfounded by their unbreakable stubbornness? Ever questioned their sanity or your own? Ever doubted yourself? Cursed the time you met them? Swore to never again fall for someone like that, yet found yourself in the same situation again, trying to get him or her to change, but failing miserably? No matter how hard we try, no matter how right we believe we are, no matter how much we are doing it for their own good, nor how pure our intention, they never seem to hear us, do they? Remarkably, however, if we leave our loved ones alone to their own devices, they often change, mysteriously and inexplicably, when we least expect them to. All these years we've tried to get them to see, fought to get them to understand, and now when we finally drop it, stop badgering them, accept the situation and either leave them or let go of trying to change them, suddenly, after all that time, who would have thought they go change on their own? They do exactly what we've been asking them to do for so long. And why do they do this? Because of us. But because they suddenly want to do it. How do we explain these strange dynamics? Let me tell you a story. It happened 4 years ago, in March, on an especially beautiful spring day. It was the kind of day that fills me with gratitude for being alive. Everything seemed right with the world. And I couldn't help but wonder why I ever had any worries when life was so amazing, so rich and abundant, so full of promise. I was about to go into my office when the telephone rang. My friend Jane's voice was hollow, devoid of all expression. She sounded as if all life had drained out of her, and it was difficult to speak at all. Still, she was making the effort. "I need to talk to you," she said. I knew what she wanted to talk about. Jane had been in a destructive, abusive relationship for 2 years with her boyfriend, Clark, who I was convinced was a con man, exploiting Jane for all she had. By the time Jane made this call, she had almost completely dropped out of sight, barely returning calls, estranging herself from all her friends. I had suspected she was in trouble and was certain that drugs were involved. I knew that she was supporting Clark, who was not working. I also knew she was hopelessly in love with him, giving him money for alcohol and drugs, paying for his keep in every way. They lived in Jane's studio apartment, which Jane, a woman of exquisite taste, had always maintained beautifully. I couldn't begin to imagine how disturbed she must have been by Clark's constant messiness, even though housekeeping must have been the least of her concerns. At the time of Jane's call, some of her friends were considering staging an intervention. But I knew from experience that interventions can only be effective if the targeted person is ready to change. It was a tough call. By then I had several conversations with Jane, sometimes initiated by her, sometimes by me, but her situation remained the same. I knew that for Jane to change externally, there need to be an internal change. There had to be a change in her consciousness, an awakening, a shift in her psyche. And until this happened, there was nothing anyone could do. And so, I didn't try to rescue Jane. I knew what happened in these cases. How many times in the past had I rushed to save a friend? How many times in the past had I felt an urgent, pressing need to get involved, to interfere, to rescue someone whom I believed to be in trouble, to save them from themselves for their own good? But the truth is, rescuers get slaughtered, all of us. The first time I heard my friend Lazarus say that, I had to pause. It was incredible, yet so simple I could have easily missed it. But the more I thought about it, the more profound these three words became. Remember the time you attempted to save your friend from her cheating husband? Did she leave him, as you had insisted? Or did she in the end turn against you? Or what about that drinking alcoholic buddy of yours, once you explained to him in no uncertain terms where he was headed? Did he stop drinking? Or did he choose instead to end his relationship with you? Remember all the times you've tried so hard to help, and instead the beneficiaries of your care got angry, furious, ungrateful, and yet you were so sure of what was right for them. It was so obvious to you. They would only listen to you and change what they were doing. They would be saved from whatever was wrong in their lives. Oh, you could see it so clearly. How come it wasn't clear to them? Were they blind, stubborn, or just stupid? Yet in the end, were you able to help? Or did you perhaps end up misunderstood and unappreciated, in spite of all your good intentions? I have yet to come across anyone who did not have good intentions. Isn't that what the road to hell is paved with? Has anybody ever had bad intentions? I had not tried to rescue Jane because I knew I could not. Instead, I held the hope that the time would come when she would make a different choice, and when it came, I would be there for her. Perhaps, I thought, listening to her breathing on the other end of the phone, this was the time. Still, I had become wary with her situation. "I need to talk to you," Jane said. "I know what I have to do." "If you know what to do, then we really don't even need to talk," I said. By then, I thought I had already told her all I could. "Oh, yes, we do," she said with sudden resolve. And I remembered how powerful she could be once she had set her mind to do something. "When can we meet?" "Any time," I said. That was the nature of our friendship. It was always any time, and one of us needed the other. "How about today?" she said. "At 1 o'clock. I'm sorry, I was not actually planning to stay on the same subject and talk about it, and then the story happened. But that, I guess that's what happened.
Does your practice today consist of still meeting people and giving them counseling like you did before? Mm-hmm.
Not a lot. So just, you know, I'm very busy. But, yes, somewhat, yeah, a few. And seminars, smaller groups, where you can really have more private and personal interaction. I think you can achieve more if it is over a prolonged period of time. It doesn't have to be, you know, people spend 10 years in therapy once a week, an hour. Not to talk bad about therapy in any way, shape, or form. But very often, you know, it just doesn't, they don't change. That's not the therapist's fault. It's our fault if we didn't change. But there are more effective ways sometimes when we can. And I do a lot of work in altered state, where you go in meditation. It's not hypnosis. You're totally in charge. You can always open your eyes and leave the room. if you know, it never happened. But we access, it's safer because you bypass the resistances. You know, okay, I want this, but it's not happening. And the why, very often it's scary to look at why. When you relax and go into, that's a guided visualization meditation. You find amazing things. That's part of the work we do. Help people forgive.
When someone is so certain that they're right and they have to change the other person, where is that certainty coming from in their experience?
Ego, control, fear.
Negative.
It's not a positive play. We believe that we're motivated by, and there is that too, you think that you can help. But it's a very arrogant position. Once you see that and continue to do that, then it's already not so good. I don't want to say good or bad, but it's not as innocent anymore. Yeah. It's scary to look at yourself and say, well, why am I with this person? The one before was just like it. And the one before was also just like it. They all look different. But I'm experiencing the same thing. Maybe it's me. It's rather than maybe this time I'll succeed in changing her or him. You know? It's not going to happen. But we can change ourselves. It's so liberating. Every time I would come upon something in myself that, quote unquote, ugly, not that I was thrilled to see it, but it's so empowering because I can do something about it. No? Blaming is really doesn't get us anywhere. Nothing. Not telling you anything you don't know. Soulmates is another trap people fall into. Is he the one? Is she the one? Well, if not, then I'm not going to bother. And I want to find a soulmate. Men and women, more women, but I have discovered that men are very much probably equal measure. And it's a myth. It's a distraction. It's a beautiful concept, and I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, but it's something we create. You don't meet a soulmate. You can meet a person where there is a tremendous connection, but you still have to create that. Soulmates are made, not met. You know? Isn't a beautiful quote? Also not mine. But I love that one too. Soulmates are made, not met. What happens is when we... Why I say that it is a dangerous thing to have, you have this list in your mind, I don't mean you, but most people, you have this imagined picture of how it would be, and usually it consists of external qualities, how she would look, or he, how he would look, what kind of education, what kind of job, what kind of level of income, what kind of house, what are we going to do, we're going to travel, we're going to eat, and that's really entertaining, nothing wrong with that. It's all wonderful, but it's not really the important things. I mean, those who have had that lifestyle have discovered this is, not enough. Okay. But if you have this list and you come across somebody who doesn't fit the picture, but is the right one, more often than not, you're going to dismiss it, and you're going to miss a very, very fabulous life-changing gift. You just dismiss it. Doesn't look right, too old, too young. Look at the clothes. What kind of car? Everyone is the same to some extent. If that doesn't matter, something else is going to matter. And you won't give that person a chance. And then I'm saying, forget about the list. Is there a heart connection? Is there a soul connection? Do you feel like you belong with each other? And use the critical thinking, but use your gut. Awesome. That a lot more chance. I just had dinner with a young woman, 27-year-old. She's very young, younger than 27 in where she is. And it was I meet myself. And there was nowhere to go. I could not even respond much because, you know, sometimes you can't because the door's closed. And if the cup is so full, you can't add a drop because it's too full. So I was just, well, God, I'm talking about it so much on the radio. Especially now with Valentine's Day, we're coming up with so much. How many times, you know, you see the... And then she was describing to me, I met, anonymous because you have no idea who she is, that's why I can tell. She was describing to me that she went to a party and there was this guy and everybody was after him and he was so successful and so gorgeous and beautifully dressed and smart and he surrounded her with absolute attention. Nobody ever paid her so much attention. She said, run away! And she looked at me like I was crazy. I said, yeah, sounds too good. Something is not right there. It's like you see the eyes across the room full of people and you connect and he's the one. Don't trust them. Mm. Well, most people connect out of their wounds, unfortunately. I talked to another young woman, younger than her, very bright and very open, and she said to me, yeah, this one is nice, and this one will treat me well, and this one is going to really be fantastic, and this one is a sarcastic asshole. Sorry. I want that one. She got the concept. Sorry for my language. I'm just quoting. Who hasn't been there? We've all done. You know, but eventually, start waking up. Other things that are more important. Do we have any questions?
Who are the people you have read or studied with whom you've enjoyed the most, got the most from?
I got the most from those others.
Jack Purcell.
Jack Russell is a channel of Vietnam president. Yeah. But, you know, you can read anybody. If it's the truth, it's the truth. Read Eckhart Tolle. Language is different. Many different teachers use different language, different words. Somebody calls it ego, somebody calls it the mind, somebody calls, you know. But if you understand the essence, it doesn't matter the words. Words sometimes can be very confusing and interfere. Truth is truth. Mm-hmm. We always know when we hear it. We just know it. Just resonates something. Yeah. Always say, trust your gut. Don't trust the thinking. When it starts, that's already the ego got in and the tape is running.
Is there anything you can say about a person who's depressed?
Yes. Depression is... A good way to understand what depression is really is, it's a bit kind of like, it'll give you an image. Imagine gauze-like thin layers of anger that started, God knows how long ago, unfelt, undealt with, something made you very angry, didn't know how to deal with it, inappropriate, whatever, settled inside. Now imagine so many gauze-like thin layers of anger, one on top of the other, on top of the other, years, sometimes decades, and they're all compressed, and now it's a heavy brick, and it's pressing, and you can't breathe, and you have no idea what it is, except... And then you're sitting in a normal day, and the person, colleague at the next desk took your stapler one more time, and you can't take it anymore. You can't have it. So anything can set it off when it becomes too much. That's pretty much the origin of depression. There is a wonderful technique, and it helps actually even clinically depressed. Want me to tell you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Imagine you're lying on the bed or whatever is at your horizontal, and do it. Lie down, and imagine that. You don't have to be clinically depressed. Now and then we all get depressed. It's like, suddenly life is too much. Okay. There, and imagine that over you is a very, very, same size as you are, a mattress or a sack that is heavy, heavy, and filled with sand or filled with flour. Sand is probably better. Something like that. And you can barely, you cannot move. it's over you, and you can barely breathe. And so, but what you can do is you reach into your pocket, you have a pocket, and there's a little penknife. And it takes all the effort you can master. You pull out this pen. It's only imagination. You don't need to relax. You just close your eyes and imagine. You open this penknife and you poke a little hole in that sack. And then you just lie there and you watch. And whatever's inside, so it sense starts seeping out. You know? And now there's a mound, and now there's a bigger mound, and a bigger mound. And now you can move. So you can kind of shake it a bit, and more is coming, and more is coming. It's not as heavy. The more visual, the more senses get involved, the better it will work. And at some point, you can lift it, and then you throw it off, and then you jump on your feet. It's all in your imagination. You jump, and you start doing like crazy stuff, somersaults, dancing, jumping, regardless of your age and physical condition. Just like, ah, hallelujah. And then you open your eyes. You'll be in a very different state. It's amazing how it works. 5 minutes.
So you're actually laying still and just visualizing your own.
Yeah, you just visualize this. Yeah. And get all your senses involved. Just see it seeping and feel how heavy. Because subconscious mind understands images much better than words. It's the language of imagination. It gets what you want. Oh. He wants to not be depressed.
But when you finish, you actually get up and throw it out.
After you open your eyes, after you have done it, you're still in your meditative state, mm-hmm. where you throw it off, because now it's light enough. That means I'm choosing to not be suppressed like that, oppressed, pressured, whatever. Throw it off, and then you jump, and then you start doing this really physical.
In your imagination.
You've never done a somersault in your life, but you can.
Here's
a trampoline. You jump on a trampoline, you turn on Elvis Presley, you start dancing. Anything, but now the body is involved and you're really like it's 180 degree shift. And when you're really like exhausted that, then you open your eyes and then you get up. It's fantastic. Clinical depressed people. You can do it as often as you want. You have a chance.
Do you have things like that in your book?
A few, yeah.
Some.
Yeah.
How to's.
Mm-hmm. Well, science is important. I explain the principles of self-acceptance. It's very hard. That's what, you know, most people don't know they matter. How I learned that, my own example. I was sitting at a workshop and I heard, you matter. There were hundreds of people. You matter. That was probably, I don't know, 15, 16, 20 years. And I started sobbing. I mean, somehow these words just... And I had no idea that I didn't think that I mattered. Never thought about it, you know? I knew that everything else mattered. My business, my son, my husband, my business, you know? Like, wasn't it selfish? Just didn't think. And suddenly to hear somebody tell you that you matter and really believe it, and that shook my world and turned it upside down, and I was crying like I couldn't stop. And now that I wrote about it in this book, I got almost word for word a couple of emails from women saying the same thing, that they read it and they couldn't stop crying. It seems like the human condition, we're not taught they will matter. But maybe our children, raised by us, well, of course, different generation, better. But our parents didn't know. It was so. What do you think? Oh, in Russia, how you were raised? I mean, you were immodest. I was told I was ugly. So was my mother. My mother was a beauty. You know, I don't look like I look at my father, but yeah, it was considered like the person, the child has to be modest. What does it do to you, to your self-esteem, to your, you know, sense of confidence? So yeah, that's so I explained why, and there are specific things, specific steps to do. And if you, yeah, there's some, yeah, there are good things there. No questions? Want some suggestion for Valentine's Day? How to not be disappointed one more time? Yeah?
Sure.
Because it's coming. For men and for women. For women. If you have the man in your life who you want to cherish you on Valentine's Day, and he never does a good job of it, you know, year after year, tell him what you want. Tell him in advance. Mostly, for the most part, men really want to make women happy. Very often they have no idea how. And it is not because they're stupid or bad people, it's because we're so different. And communication is a whole other subject. Understanding each other. They don't know how. They think you're going to like that. It's exactly what you don't want. So, and so we have two options. I learned it in my own skin, so to say. The two options. Be unhappy again, or risk being unhappy again, or make sure that you're not. And I've learned it with my husband. But we're not even married at the time. It took us 7.5 years to get married. Otherwise I couldn't overcome it. This is all here. Actually, it's interesting. Because I had such a scar after the first marriage. I thought, no, anything but that. Crazy. So anyway, not really crazy, but for me, I came from a traditional background. In the Soviet Union, everyone's married. And everybody has children. We didn't have that option. I mean, you'd be ostracized if you didn't. So for me not to want to get married was very unusual. Anyway, I realized that Valentine's is coming and he's going to forget again. He's forgetful. Not because he doesn't love. So I said, Valentine's is in a week. It's on Thursday. You sure you remember? Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, this is what I want. Oh, wonderful. No, it was an amazing experiment. And I said, okay, if we go to dinner, these are the places that we can go and you can pick, but I would be happy with either. Okay, and then 2 days before, Valentine's is in 2 days. Are you sure you remember? Oh, thank you. Thank you, thank you. And I don't want to get the flowers in the evening. I want to wake up to the flowers. How am I going to do that? You get them in advance. Honest to God. Well, you're going to see them.
Hide them.
Hide them. Because where am I going to hide them? Yeah, come. You want me to tell you where to hide them? No, thank you. And you know what? We had the best time. And I realized, I didn't feel stupid. I didn't have any. It was fun. I mean, it was fun. We had the best time. And I realized it helped him, it helped me. If he forgets, it's not because he doesn't love me, but because of how he is. He thinks about other things. Then he gets very unhappy because I'm very unhappy. And he knows that he caused it. And both of us are unhappy. And what good does that do? After a few years of that, I learned something else. And now I'm teaching that women tell your man what you want to make. The same with a birthday. Women remember, men don't. John Gray talks about it and explains why. Somebody almost is writing a book with the title, Why Men Forget and Women Remember. It's actually a biological thing. So, but anyway, and the men ask your women, what would you like to do? Because more often than not, you'll guess wrong. She'll be unhappy. She just asks. And you can use this in this model, not just for Valentine's. Whatever you want, just tell them. What's the big deal? I know, we expect our loved ones to psychically figure out what we want without us bothering to tell them. That's not very intelligent. No. And it's setting a trap, you know, for them and for us. Mm-hmm. But if there's an agenda, then it's not going to work. If you're neutral, if you're looking at this, not a big deal, then it's going to work wonderfully well. I think you're such an idiot, I better tell you, I better not tell. Okay, well, what are we? 20 to 9.
Yeah.
Mm. More? I can read more, can talk more.
What happened to your friend?
Oh, this is a fabulous story. Their friend, so we sat and talked for 4 hours. Well, I'll tell you the story, but it's okay, there's more in the book. For 4 hours we sat and talked, and she told me, and it was a horror story. I had no idea how bad it was. Nobody knew how bad it was. But she never told us. You know? And so, and she looked, you know, now she looks fabulous, but you know, after a couple of years of that life, she didn't look very healthy or happy. It was really very painful to see. So we talked for 4 hours, and it was a moment of grace. Somehow, you know how it happens when you don't need to change the person, where you're just there for them, you have a lot of clarity, because the agendas are not there. And I listened, and by then she had lost her health insurance, she was very sick, she was continuously, she had some kind of stomach problems, very bad, couldn't call the doctor, couldn't go to the emergency because she was there, because she couldn't pay him, and it was horrible. So I listened, we were talking, and then I said to her suddenly, and I wasn't planning that, I said, you can do what you want, but if this is going to stay like that, you're going to die. And I wasn't trying to scare her at all. That never works anyway. I just saw it. And she just looked at me, and she goes, are you serious? I said, yeah. You're going to die, and there's nothing wrong, you know, you can die, except it's not going to be easy. You're not going to die in your sleep. It's just a blessing. You're probably going to have poverty and hardship and illness and kind of thing. And because there was no judgment coming from her, it wasn't making her bad or wrong at all, just what I saw. She had and it was she woke up so suddenly, and then we were talking more, and she says, I don't know what to do. But she always wanted to live in San Rafael. She lived in San Francisco with this guy, and he wasn't going to move. There was no way. She was terrified to tell him. Even if an army of us were to come to the house and to the apartment to throw him out, suppose we would be back tomorrow, she'd let him in. So, well, and I said, you know, remember how you always wanted to live in San Rafael, in a warm climate? You can do that. And she goes, well, how can I do that? I have no money to move. I said, I can give you money. And you know what? I was not saving ever. And I wasn't planning, and in fact, when she wanted to borrow money in the past, I made a decision never to give her money anymore, because she was a notorious borrower, she never paid back, and it was only supporting what was going on. And suddenly, I mean, I'm saying things that, because this is when the moment of grace, when you don't know, you're just kind of in the moment. And I said, no, I'll give you money. It's not a lot of money. At that time, I could do it. This is the first month's rent, you know, security deposit. And she goes, well, I can never pay you back. It's not wrong. Wouldn't you do the same for me? And suddenly, and there was this future suddenly, that it wasn't there before. There was no future like that. And suddenly, the power of the possible, the door opened, and suddenly there was this dream that was now a very probable reality. No? And with this, we more or less left. And I had no idea what she was going to do. Nor did she. After 4 hours, I mean, she completely was exhausted. She couldn't even absorb it anymore. You know? It was too much. And so I drove home, and I thought, oh, let's see what happened. In a couple of hours, the telephone rings. And it's her. And she says, well, guess what happened? She walked for a couple of hours, maybe a little less. She walked, and she cleared her head. She completely forgot about the fact that I offered to help her to move. Because that wasn't really important. Important was that she changed. She woke up and she realized she's not going to have this life anymore. So she came home. She was not afraid. She turned. He was watching TV. She took the remote, clicked the remote, turned to him, and spoke. And she described that as amazing. Without making him bad, without accusations, she took responsibility for her part. She basically described the situation, and she said, and it's over. And you're leaving. And next day, he was gone. And that's 2003, so 6 years. nobody heard from her. We never had her. Disappeared. And then we went to San Rafael, found the place, immediately the first book. That's it. Complete change around. And then she told her sister, a therapist, professional therapist, that Ariella said that if I don't leave him, I will die. And the sister was just horrified. She said, this is just terrible. How can you say something like that to a person? And this is awful. This is horrible. This is too harsh. But it was the truth. Who knows whether she died or not? You know, that was I saw it very clearly. But I'm not psychic. If I am, I mean, it's not that function. No, it wasn't horrible. I had no agenda. It wasn't scary. But it's interesting, you know, that reaction. But she wasn't even taking calls from her sister. Her sister just tried to help all the time. So anyway, that's the happy ending. There's more. Well, I'm fine. I have if you want, I'd be thrilled, of course, if it's exciting to you. I will send you information on things that I do, because a number of you ask.
I'll put a sign up list up here.
Yeah.
People, do you have a sign up list there?
I have a stamp. It's probably enough. It's not enough, then we'll get some papers here. And I have enter to win. The first three names drawn will win a free telephone consultation regarding any relationship or life issues. Next five names drawn can submit their relationship questions to be answered via email. I can pull them at the end. We can do a little drawing. But please, when you write your email, spell it. Because sometimes I look and I cannot make it up.
Did you mean print it?
Yeah, I'm so spelled, sorry. Print it. Yeah, and look at it again, whether it's clear or not. Sometimes, you know, it's clear to us, but it's not really that clear. I have quite a number of people in the area. You know, I made a couple of workshops here. Because I'm a contributing author to Peak Vitality. It's a wonderful anthology with a lot of great... it's a book, obviously. A lot of great authors there. Deepak Chopra there, Marianne Williamson, John Gray, Mehmet Oz, and a few new voices. Among them was I. Came out almost a year ago. And the launch was in Sebastian. That's how I met a number of people. At the launch party, they put me in the room and said, if you have any questions, ask Ariella. And I don't know what people thought. They thought maybe I'm psychic or maybe I'm going to do cards. And I thought, who is ever going to come in into that room? And it will be busy all evening. It was fun. So anyway, I'll leave that. My cards are here if you want information. That's it.
Thank you.
If you're going to get the books, I will be happy to sign them.
And you'll be willing to hang out a while, so if people
absolutely
have questions.
Absolutely, I am staying, having fun. Yes.
Yeah, good. Thank you so much. That was
such
beautiful.
A pleasure.
And thank you so much for coming tonight. It was it's wonderful to see you all, as always. Really. And the Many Rivers Books and Tea, most of you know, has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. So there's a donation basket on the counter. Any amount that you can contribute will be gratefully received. A portion of the donation goes to our speaker to support her work.
Oh, really?
Yes, it always surprises our guests.
We're
the only store that does that. And
yeah,
a portion goes to Many Rivers Books and Tea so that we can continue to have events here on Thursday evenings. Our schedule of events for February is now out. It's at the end of the counter, so if you want to know more about our upcoming events, it's there. And thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it.
Do you advertise your events on WACO?
Yes, we do. They're on WACO. Is that right, Amba?
Yes. This is such a wonderful story, you know.
Thank you again.
Amazing.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. I wish we could meet in person, you know. Maybe there will be
cancel.
Chances, you know.
But why didn't...